So we're going to be talking about Darwin's theory today and what's wrong with it, but you're starting off on the right foot, which is why this is relevant, because some of our viewers might think, hey, you guys are just talking about some biological theory. That's not interesting to me. What's this got to do with the SGT report? And so let's talk a little about the relevance first, and then we'll talk about what's wrong with the theory from a science viewpoint. And here's the thing, Sean. If a person is a Christian, or maybe not even a strong Christian, but they have kids and they see that our culture is going pretty crazy, they see the transgender thing unfolding, and they see the satanic images coming out of Hollywood movies. You were just talking about the Swiss railway ceremony. So they say, well, I want my kids to have a moral foundation. So even though maybe they're not a strong Christian, they bring their kids to church, send them to Sunday school. And what do they learn in church and in the Bible? They learn that God created the heavens and the earth, and that God created all life forms, and that God created man in his image. And that's all in the book of Genesis. However, if your kids are going to public school, they are now hearing something else. They're hearing that God didn't create the heavens and the earth. The Big Bang, an all-natural event, did that. And God didn't create life forms. Life forms simply came about because chemicals randomly came together in an ancient primordial soup and formed our single-celled ancestors, which then evolved. And man is not created in the image of God. According to the theory of evolution, he's actually created in the image of ape. We just evolved from these ape-like creatures through natural selection and survival of the fittest. Now, if your child is a thinking child, he or she is going to start to ask a question, and they're going to say, I'm hearing two different stories here. Who's right? Is my Bible right, or is my science teacher right? And a lot of these kids, Sean, they'll say, maybe that stuff I'm hearing in church is just a bunch of hooey. I mean, what is the pastor though? He went to seminary, big deal. These science guys, they establish things through scientific method, and if evolution has been established to be a scientific truth, it must be true. And these kids, many of them give up on God. In fact, I want to give you a quote. This is from the leading spokesperson for evolution of the 20th century, Julian Huxley, the brother of Aldous. He said this, quote, "Darwinism removed the whole idea of God as the creator of organisms from the sphere of rational discussion." So, unquote. So according to Huxley, you're not even rational if you still believe in God after being exposed to Darwin. And I do want to mention, I think it is important to mention, that some people will say, hey, I went to school and I studied evolution. It didn't harm me any. What's the big deal? And, I believe in the Bible and evolution. You got a problem with that? And actually, I do have a little bit of a problem with that, because if you look at the account of creation in the Bible of Adam and Eve, it's radically different from Darwin's theory of millions of years and evolving from apes. Now, some people will try to symbolize the Bible and say that Adam and Eve were just symbolic of ape men. But, if they're symbolic, where does the Bible stop being symbolic? And the main thing I want to stress is, even though some people say, gee, what's the big deal? I think they're compatible. A lot of people look at it and see it's clearly a contradiction, and they give up on the idea of God altogether, and become atheists or agnostics. And I'm going to give you some examples of that, but let me pause here. I don't want to
Yeah,
just
well, no, I agree with you, and I want to just jump in and say that, Charles Darwin lived from 1809 to 1882, James. Do you think science has gotten a little better since then? I want to ask you what's wrong with Darwin's theories. But before I do that, I want to point out to people that science has gotten a whole lot better, guys. CERN is an amazing accomplishment. They hatched the idea in the 50s. It took them this long to get the thing up and running. And it reminds me of the Tower of Babel. I think CERN is a modern-day Tower of Babel. And the people behind CERN want to rip open the veil. They want to see God. They want to see the God particle. They want to be gods, essentially. And I think it's very, very dangerous. It's a slippery slope. And the reason I bring it up is because I think it speaks to, as does the Goddard Tunnel Ceremony, what they really believe. So whether or not, James, our listeners are spiritual, whether they're atheists, it really doesn't matter, because the elite believe something. I think they believe in a satanic agenda, satanic power, that they're pursuing at a very, very rapid pace, which again is why this conversation is so very relevant. I hope that even the atheists will stick with us here, because I promise you, James is going to take us on a path that is really going to make you think. James, what is wrong with Charles Darwin's theories?
If I can just back up for a moment, I just wanted to exemplify what I was saying before about atheism and agnosticism coming out of Darwin's theory.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to actually give you some examples just to make it clear how relevant this is and why they wanted this to happen from the theory. I was an atheist at one time, and I was not raised in a religious home. But I didn't have any adversity towards the Bible until the sixth grade, Lexington, Mass, public school, Parker School, elementary school, sixth grade. My teacher, Mr. Horowitz, was teaching us evolution. And I had a little classmate who was a Christian, and she raised her hand and said, "Well, Mr. Horowitz, that's not what the Bible says." And he looked at the girl with almost pity in his eyes, and he said, "Well, I'm sorry, dear, but science has proven that the Bible is wrong." And my classmates piped up. They said, yeah, science has proven the Bible is wrong. It's a bunch of malarkey. Didn't you even know that? And Sean, this is a very significant moment in my life, because this is the moment that I said, oh, so the Bible's just an old myth, and God doesn't really exist. God is just, like the Easter Bunny or the Tooth Fairy, it's just an old myth. And I didn't know it, but I was taking the first step towards being an atheist, which I became. And I also became a left-wing hippie. And I don't know if you ever noticed this, Sean, but atheists and agnostics tend to be left-wingers and not conservatives politically. But let me give you four quick examples of other people that this happened to, just so people won't think it's just me, okay? There was this Boy Scout who was in the news a few years ago. He's threatened with expulsion from the Boy Scouts because he was an atheist, and you're supposed to believe in God and the Boy Scouts, at least at that time. His name was Daryl Lambert. And I'll give you an exact quote. This is what he told the media. He said, quote, "I'm an atheist. I believe in evolution," unquote. And so the same thing that happened to me happened to him. He was taught the theory of evolution, thought that it discredited God. To take a more famous individual, E.O. Wilson, biologist at Harvard University, wrote this, quote, "As were many persons from Alabama, I was a born-again Christian. When I was 15, I entered the Southern Baptist Church with great fervor and interest in the fundamentalist religion. I left at 17 when I got to the University of Alabama and heard about evolutionary theory," unquote. Now, to take it into the geopolitical sphere, most of us have heard of Andrew Carnegie, the steel magnate. Some people said he was almost as rich as John D. Rockefeller. Atheist and founder of the beloved Carnegie Endowment Foundation, right? All right, here's a quote from his autobiography. Quote, "When I, along with three or four of my boon companions, was in this state of doubt about theology, including the supernatural, and indeed the whole scheme of salvation, I came fortunately upon Darwin's works. I remember that light came as in a flood, and all was clear. Not only had I got rid of theology and the supernatural, but I had found the truth of evolution," unquote, Andrew Carnegie. And one more, let's go from capitalism to communism. We've all heard of Joseph Stalin, mass murderer of millions, dictator of the Soviet Union. I'm going to quote from a book published in Moscow in 1940. It's his biography. It's called Landmarks in the Life of Stalin. Quote, "At a very early age, while still a pupil in the ecclesiastical school," religious school, right, "Comrade Stalin developed a critical mind and revolutionary sentiments. He began to read Darwin and became an atheist. Ziegler Jidzi, a boyhood friend of Stalin's, relates, I began to speak of God. Joseph heard me out and after a moment's silence said, you know, they're fooling us. There is no God. I was astonished at these words. I had never heard anything like it before. How can you say such things, so-so? I exclaimed. I'll lend you a book to read. It will show you that the world and all living things are quite different from what you imagine. And all this talk about God is sheer nonsense," Joseph said. "What book is that?" I inquired. "Darwin. You must read it," Joseph impressed on me. Unquote. Landmarks in the Life of Stalin. Now, we could go on, but I just wanted to make it clear that Darwinism for well over a century has been turning people into agnostics and atheists. And I also want to say one more thing about this, Sean. Why is it because Darwin was financed, okay, he got financial help. Why is it that the powers that be, the Rothschilds, wanted to introduce this theory and have it impressed upon the public? And you actually touched on this on the beginning. Once you remove God as the creator and replace it with chance processes, which is what Darwin's theory does, you make the Bible an old myth. When you make the Bible an old myth, the Ten Commandments are an old myth. And what do the Ten Commandments teach you? That you shouldn't kill, shouldn't steal, shouldn't lie, right? Good stuff, right?
Yeah.
All right. But the Rothschilds wanted a world in which politicians and newscasters would lie, in which bankers would steal for them, and in which eugenicists and soldiers would kill for them in their population control program, okay? So it was very important for them to have this theory advanced as science and as fact. And, of course, a Darwinist at this point in our conversation, I know what they would say, Sean, because I used to be an evolutionist myself. An evolutionist would say, well, you know what? I don't believe in any of this garbage you guys are saying about the so-called moral implications of Darwinism. But even if I did, so what? Darwin's theory is as well proven as the laws of gravity. It's a science like physics and chemistry. And you know what? If you disagree with it, you're obviously anti-science. You might as well be against physics and chemistry as well.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's really the segue into our next phase. And the main phase is what's wrong with the theory scientifically. We want to show that actually scientifically it's bogus.
Yeah, I want you to dismantle this because I'll play devil's advocate because, you know, you're right.
That's what they are.
The naysayers will say, hey, look, on the origin of species, it proves Darwin's theory is absolutely right. And you people are nuts. You people are Bible believing nuts if you think that it's not true. We know evolution is fact. Darwin proved it. And I just want to say a couple things. Again, getting back to the fact that the man wrote the book in the 1800s, we now know that on the molecular level, you know, they used to believe, this guy believed that the smaller things got, the simpler things got. And the exact opposite is true, James. They've now realized that the smaller they go onto the quantum level, there's evidence of complexity so magnificent that it speaks to a designer, and many atheist scientists have even come out to say just that. So I want to ask you, what is wrong with Darwin's On the Origin of Species that the establishment still bitterly clings to as a piece of faith, just like they cling to the Big Bang, which is nothing more than a theory? What's wrong with On the Origin of Species?
Well, we're going to present four proofs that it's wrong, and then we're going to take two proofs that the evolutionists use and show where they're flawed. And I think the best place to start is at the beginning of life. Oh, we know. You know what, Sean? I want you to put a graphic up on the screen because I think it's important we give our audience a one-minute refresher on what the theory of evolution says.
Can do. What?
What the theory says is that life began in the ocean billions of years ago when the right chemicals formed our single-celled ancestors by chance. And then these single-celled creatures began to evolve into multicellular creatures, and they became the first seagoing invertebrates, a creature without a backbone like a jellyfish. Then the invertebrates evolved into fish, and then fish yearned to come ashore, and so their fins started to evolve into legs, and they became the first amphibians, which are creatures, of course, that can go on land or water like a frog. And then amphibians evolved into reptiles, reptiles evolved into mammals, and then eventually within the class of mammals, you had these ape-like creatures who evolved into man. And that's the theory in a nutshell. It might be taught a little differently from one school of thought to another, but that's it. And that's basically what your kids are taught in school. So to start at the beginning, the origin of life, and Darwin did talk about that, the origin of species, said that life began in a warm little pond, but after a while they realized that a pond wouldn't last long enough for significant evolution to take place, so they changed it to the ocean. So let's see what's wrong with this. Now, I've got a can here of all-natural cola. And if we look at it, it says cola. It says 12 ounces, which it reminds us, in this case, is 354 mLs.
I laughed because you said all-natural cola. I don't think there's anything natural about cola, but go ahead.
Well, it's from Whole Foods.
It's
as natural as cola can get. Let's put it that way.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Copy.
All right. Now, it says Whole Foods on it, and it's got a list of ingredients, the amount of fat and sodium, and it's got a barcode, which is scannable, and it's got a pop top. which works very nicely, and it's got cola inside, very tasty, right? Now, does anybody think that this can and its contents and the printing on the outside could have originated by pure chance? And obviously not. I mean, it's too well designed. So that raises the question of how could a cell come about by chance, because it's astronomically more complex than the can I just showed you. And I want to give you a quote. The quote is this, quote, "A simple one-cell bacterium, R. coli, contains DNA information units that are the equivalent of 100 million pages of Encyclopedia Britannica," unquote. And that quote is from the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, cells have a functional unit called proteins. That's their basic unit. And even in a bacterial cell, there's thousands of different proteins. And not to get technical, but proteins are found down in a smaller building block called amino acids, and there's hundreds in one protein, and they have to be in the right order. And some of your listeners, I'm sure, have heard of Francis Crick. He won the Nobel Prize for co-discovering the structure of DNA. And he calculated what the odds would be of getting a protein by chance, you know, NaH in ocean. You know what the odds are, according to Francis Crick? The odds are 1 in 10 to the power of 260. And if you want to know how big a number that is, you couldn't fit that many electrons in the known universe. Mathematicians usually say that anything with odds greater than 1 in 10 to the power of 50 is impossible. So it would be impossible to get one protein by chance, let alone the thousands a cell would need. And think about it. A cell would need the ability to ingest nutrients, expel waste. And really think about this one. This first cell formed by chance before it died in the span of one lifetime would have had to develop and perfect the process of cellular reproduction, because if it didn't, there never would have been a second cell, and Darwin's evolutionary process would stop right there.
Yeah, I just love that. I also love the metaphor of a tornado in a junkyard. Maybe you could just briefly share that story for people, with people, because I think it's so powerful. And I'd like to mention that my friend Thomas Gailey recently wrote an article that we posted at SGT Report called "The Problems with Evolutionary Theory." You guys can Google that and read Tom's article. I bring it up because the comments section was filled with people who agreed and disagreed. So this is a very, very, again, relevant and important topic, because it's very, very difficult to sway people who are strict Darwinists into our camp, which is the camp that believes that there is a designer and there was a creator from day one. Can you tell people about Tornado in a Junkyard? Just share that story. I just love it.
Well, that's the title of my first book on Darwinism, and I borrowed the imagery from Sir Fred Hoyle, the noted British astronomer. He was asked what he thought the chances were of higher life forms evolving by Darwinian processes, and he said that the odds would be the same as a tornado sweeping through a junkyard and leaving behind a perfectly assembled Boeing 747. Yeah. And I love that imagery, so I chose it for the title of my book.
Yeah, it's fantastic, and it speaks to the complexity of, quote-unquote, the design. Again, that Coke can, not nearly as complex as a cell or a strand of DNA, and yet it, too, had a designer. Okay, let's move on. Let's continue to deconstruct Darwin.
All right. I just want to mention, by the way, we're talking about science. Science is based on observations, and there are no observations to support this idea that a cell could come about by chance. I mean, nobody's ever seen chemicals randomly assemble themselves into working functional cellular parts. Okay. But our second of four evidences is genetics. And, of course, genes dictate what our, physical makeup is. Now, a zebra can't give birth to a baby kangaroo. Why? Because she hasn't got kangaroo genes. A woman can't even be born with blonde hair unless she's got genes for blonde hair, right? Otherwise, she's got to use a Lady Clairol. Now, Darwin didn't know about genetics. As we were saying, science is advancing. It was not a science in his day, at least when he wrote The Origin of Species. And when Darwinists first heard of genetics, when they learned about it, they first resisted it. And the reason was they realized, you know, we don't have to just explain in our theory how the anatomical features came about by evolution. We now have to explain how the new genes came about, because, you know, if we came from a fish, you know, a fish's gene pool is radically different than a human's gene pool. So where the genes come from? And this originally stumped the Darwinists, but they came up with a solution. And what the solution was, Sean, it was mutations. random mutations, which are a copying mistake in the genetic code. They occur very rarely, but they do occasionally happen, and they do change genetic information,
well,
right?
Cancer is a mutation, too.
Yeah.
There's a definite downside to some mutations, James.
I'll say. They say that mutations are the building block of evolutionary change. So in other words, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago, some fish got a random mutation that gave a little bit of an arm, right? And this was conferred such a great survival advantage that it spread through those fish. And then lo and behold, another mutation came along, which gave it a little bit more of an arm until finally the fish had, through mutation, developed an arm. Okay, here's the problem with that. As science is advancing, as you said, we now have this book, Not by Chance, Shattering the Modern Theory of Evolution by Dr. Lee Spetner, who is no dweeb. Maybe I didn't hold that up in a way you can really see it. But Dr. Spetner, MIT grad, PhD, taught information science for years at Johns Hopkins University and the Weizmann Institute. And here's what he writes in his book. Quote, "In all the reading I've done in life sciences literature, I've never found a mutation that added information. All point mutations that have been studied on the molecular level turn out to reduce the genetic information and not increase it."
Yeah.
Unquote. So what he's saying here is mutations... I'm sorry.
They're destructive. Mutations can be destructive.
They are almost universally destructive. They always destroy function. They never add it. They always reduce information, never increase it. Now, just again, science is based on observation. So what do we observe mutations do to human beings? They give you sickle cell anemia, cystic fibrosis, Down syndrome, hemophilia, and about 4,000 other genetic diseases. They never improve us, yet they're supposed to be the building blocks of evolutionary improvement, right? And now, I want you to put another graphic up on the screen for our viewers, because evolutionists will object at this point and say that there are such a things as beneficial mutations. And the one I want you to put up is the one called sickle cell anemia. Now, I've been on radio and had an evolutionist call up and say, sickle cell anemia, and this is a common argument, by the way, sickle cell anemia is a wonderful example of how mutations create evolution. Now, why do they say this? What's the benefit of sickle cell anemia? Because it's a disease. Well, the benefit is that people with sickle cell do not get malaria. And so the argument is that mutations have redesigned, reconstructed the red blood cells so we don't get malaria. Okay, so let's look at the picture, and we see a normal red blood cell, and below that a sickle cell. Now, the sickle cell is deformed. It is misshapen. The function of red blood cells is to transport oxygen. It's lost function. It does not transport oxygen as well as a normal cell. It clogs your arteries. It causes intense pain. And I used to work with sickle cell victims back in the 70s. And back then, before medical advances, it was common for people to die in their 20s from this disease. Nobody hopes that their child will get sickle cell anemia because it prevents malaria. Now, it's true that the parasites that cause malaria don't like to go into these deformed cells, but that's just like you wouldn't want to move into a house that was all dilapidated, you know? It has lost function. It has lost information. You know what, Sean? If I cut off my legs, I won't get athlete's foot. It'll prevent a disease, right? So that's a benefit, right? But it's not evolution. All mutations will delete information and function. They don't add to it. That's Dr. Spetner's point, and that is our proof number two against the theory of evolution.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you talk about all this. So many of us know this information. To others, it's new, and that's because of the public schools, because of the indoctrination, the Darwinist indoctrination. And as we talk about this, James, you know what vision comes to mind? Frankenstein science is what Darwin's theory of evolution is. It's Frankenstein science, and you can't have the beauty we see in nature happen by accident or by chance mutation. If it happened by chance mutation, we wouldn't see beautiful tropical birds and beautiful tropical fish. We would see monstrous results, in my opinion. Now, I want to ask you about the historical record. This comes from my friend Thomas. Is there any evidence in the fossil record to support evolution? I've never seen it. And, you know, let's talk about the missing link. Is there any fossil record that supports these jumps between species?
Great question. So what you should really do is I want to ask you to put the picture called Evolution Sequence back on the screen. And we see these organisms, right? We see these microorganisms, invertebrates, fish, to amphibians, to reptiles, to mammals. That's a sequence that Darwin proposed and which is still taught in public schools today. All right. So if we look at these pictures, Sean, there are tens of thousands of species that fit into these categories, germs, invertebrates, fish, amphibians, reptiles, and mammals. But how many species are there that are intermediate? Zero. Not one. Nada. But there should be many. Darwin said the number would be inconceivably great. In fact, I'm going to ask you to put another picture up, which is a microcosm of this picture. It's called fish to amphibian. Now, to think about it, for a fish to become a walking land creature, it wouldn't have to just evolve new bones. It would have to evolve new muscles to support those bones and new nerves to control the movements of the limbs. And while it was coming on shore, it would have to evolve a whole new breathing system. Now, according to evolutionists themselves, this happened by chance mutations. So as you can imagine, in the red arrow area here, the in-between phase, there would have to be millions of creatures living and dying. And as I said, Darwin himself said the number would be inconceivably great. So where are they? Why is it that we have no overlaps? The founder of taxonomy, Carolus Linnaeus, he's the guy who started calling creatures by genus, species. He invented those terms, right? He was against evolution because he saw there were no overlaps. So how did Darwinists explain this? Here's how they explain it. All the intermediate transitional forms became extinct.
Well, that's convenient.
Okay. Well, you know, that's like saying that my dog ate my homework. Yeah. The translation of they all became extinct is we ain't got no proof. Just as there's no proof for a cell coming out by chance. If you can put on that the screen one more time, this is the last time I'll ask for it, that evolution sequence from microorganism to human. This is what I want to say. We started out as basically a bacterium, a single-celled creature who evolved into a human. But did you know, Sean, science is based on observation, right? Did you know by actual observation, we've never seen one species of bacteria evolve into another species of bacteria? This is a quote from Alan H. Litton, Professor Emeritus of Bacteriology at the University of Bristol in England. Quote, throughout 150 years of the science of bacteriology, there is no evidence that one species of bacteria has changed into another. Unquote. How do you like them apples? We're supposed to believe bacteria became people, but by actual observation, no species of bacteria has even changed to another species of bacteria.
Yeah.
So bacteria, talk about your life.
Yeah. Bacteria became human beings, right? This precious, beautiful design. They also happened to become wolves, and they also happened to become fish, and they also happened to become apes, and they also happened to become... It's absolutely absurd, but so often I'll hear people whose intellect I respect. Joe Rogan has a very popular podcast, and Joe Rogan consistently will talk about evolution, and he will cite wolves and dogs. He'll say, all the dog breeds came from wolves. There's your example of evolution. I'm tired of hearing people talk about creation. What's wrong with that thesis? It's far too simple in my opinion, James, because it only speaks to intra-species evolution, which I think has been documented, but it does not speak to one species becoming another species. Where's Joe Rogan got it wrong when he talks about dog breeds?
We're going to get to that. But I want to back up and handle your question on fossils first. Can we do that?
Coach, you bet. I'm too excited, man. I'll slow down. All right. Okay. Let's back up.
Yeah, we're definitely going to get to that. The fossils, because, since there are no transitional or in-between forms in the living world, the evolutionists will say it's in the fossil record, and you had asked about that. Let's just touch on that. In my books, I have quotes from evolutionists themselves that there are no transitional forms between any of these major groups. But we haven't got time for that, so I'm going to give you one coverall quote. And this is from Colin Patterson, senior paleontologist at the British Museum of Natural History. In fact, he was the director of the British Museum. Quote, the American Museum people are hard to contradict when they say there are no transitional fossils. As a paleontologist myself, I am much occupied with the philosophical problems of identifying ancestral forms in the fossil record. I will lay it on the line. There is not one such fossil for which one could make a watertight argument, unquote, Colin Patterson. You'll find the quotes and citations in my books. Let's take a couple examples because you will see, evolution will argue against this, of course, because every once in a while you will see a spectacular headline saying a missing link's been found. Let's take two examples of missing links, okay, that have been discredited. Put the picture up of Piltdown Man.
Right.
Now,
complete fraud.
Yeah. Here we have the Piltdown Man surrounded by scientists. The guy in the white suit is Sir Arthur Keith, noted anatomist. And looking over his shoulder is Sir Grafton Elliot Smith. And you have these other Darwinists. By the way, the reason they're called Sir is because they were knighted for their work on the Piltdown Man.
They serve the queen.
They're still doing it, right? Still serving the different queens.
Many people do.
Anyway, what was the Piltdown Man? The Piltdown Man was an alleged ape man found in a gravel pit not too far from Darwin's home. And it consisted of a jawbone and a skull. And when the find was announced in 1912, you know what the headline was in the New York Times? It was Darwin Theory Proved True.
Right.
Oh, you can always rely on good old mainstream media, you know.
Hearst, that was probably a Hearst publication. Hearst himself wrote that one.
He would have. I think the New York Times beat him to the punch. He was over on the New York Journal, right? But anyway, okay, so this alleged ape man, which they said was 500 million years old, was on display at the British Museum for about 40 years before it was discovered to be a fake. What it actually was not 500 million years old. The lower jawbone was a modern orangutan jaw. Somebody had simply filed down the teeth to make them more human-looking and stained it to make it look old. And they put it together in the pit with a human skull, which they also stained to make it look old. And it fooled all these guys at the British Museum, although, who knows, maybe one or two were even involved with the fraud. Who knows? But some people would say, okay, well, that was a clever forgery. You know, anyone could be fooled by a forgery, but no one could be fooled by a real fossil. So let's take an example of how you can be fooled by a real fossil. So I'd like you to put on the screen the image I've called coelacanth fossil. And what we're looking at is the coelacanth was a fish found in Jurassic Rock, the age of the dinosaurs. And for years, evolutionists said it had been extinct for tens of millions of years. And they said it was a transition between fish and amphibians. And if you look at this fossil, it looks like it's walking, right? They said this is a walking fish. Look, it's got little legs there. Here's the problem. In 1938, somebody caught a live coelacanth off the coast of Madagascar. And since then, hundreds more have been caught. And if you could put the image now on the screen of live coelacanth, examination of the coelacanth proved it was 100% fish, no amphibian characteristics. Now, why is it so easy to be fooled by a fossil? Because 99% of the biology of any creature is in its soft anatomy, which you cannot access on a fossil. And that makes it very easy to fill in the other 99%, fill in besides the 1% you can see with your imagination. And that's fossils. You'll see an occasional spectacular one announced, but there should be an inconceivably great number of these fossils if the theory is true. And, of course, we don't see those. All right. The fourth area of evidence that I'd like to address today comes from Dr. Michael Behe, who's a biochemist at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. He's written this book, Darwin's Black Box, The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution. And in this book, he talks about something called irreducible complexity. Now, what he means by that is that in the human body and other creatures, there are certain systems that are very complex and that consist of interdependent parts. You take away one or two parts, the whole system won't work. Ergo, they cannot have evolved. Now, that sounds abstract, so let's take a practical example that he gives. If we get a cut and we bleed, the body stops that with a blood clot. Now, a blood clot might look simple to the naked eye. But it's actually a very complex process. Sean, if you could put up on the screen what I called blood clotting cascade. It's well over a dozen steps to make a blood clot. And a person with hemophilia, which is a disease caused by mutation, is missing factor 8, which I've circled there. And they're at high risk for bleeding. Now, if you were missing two or three factors in the blood clotting process, no chance for survival, you'll bleed to death. So here's the question Dr. Behe asked. How could evolution have produced this? Because in the Darwinian model, blood clotting would have evolved over eons as random mutations introduced each step of the process. But that doesn't work. Three steps won't do you any good. Six won't do you any good. Or nine. If you've only got nine steps of the blood clotting process, you'll bleed to death. And if you bleed to death, you can't pass on the incremental stages to the next generation. And so the point that Dr. Behe makes is that this whole system had to be in place from the very beginning, which would indicate an intelligent designer. Now, he goes on, he shows the same thing with human vision. You know, what came first? Was it the retina, the optic nerve? They've all got to be there. Same thing with the immune system. What came first? Antibodies, white blood cells, they all have to be working together. So Dr. B is not a Bible thumper, But his point is that there are systems which evolution cannot explain. That's our fourth and last evidence against evolution. But if we have time, I'd like to take two evidences, including Joe Rogan's, that evolutionists use, and look at the flaws in them.
Oh, yeah, please do. Let's talk about Rogan's thesis that all dog breeds that we see have come from the wolf, so it's a proof of evolution. But that's just an intra-species example. Where does Rogan have it wrong?
Just what you said. Okay, if your kids go to public school, the teacher will say something like this. They'll say, kids, how can those crazy intelligent design people say there's no evolution? There's a gazillion examples of evolution around us, and they'll use dog breeding as an example, the various breeds of dog. They'll say plant breeders develop new breeds of corn, and racehorse owners develop faster racehorse owners. So they'll say, look, if you get a little bit of change over a little bit of time, you could get unlimited change over unlimited time, and thus the theory of evolution is true. So let's see where this is wrong, let's see where it's flawed. Let's take dog breeds, and if you could put the picture up that I gave you called dog breeds. It's true that there are a lot of different dog breeds, but dog breeders didn't put new genes to these dogs. God endowed dogs with a rich gene pool. The fact of the matter is that dogs are all part of a single species. And so what we want to stress here is that variation within a type, and that would include the wolf, okay, because wolves, coyotes, and dogs can all interbreed. Variation within a type is not the same thing as evolution, which is changing one kind of animal to another, changing a fish to an amphibian to a reptile to a mammal. Totally different. Now, to make this a little clearer, if you could put up the graphic called human race, we take a look at the great variety of among human beings, everything from African pygmies to Japanese sumo wrestlers, right? There's over 7 billion people on Earth, and no two are exactly alike. And why is that? Because God gave us a rich gene pool, and that is a very intelligent design for man, because it's that rich gene pool that gives us our individual identity. You know, Sean, if you and I had the exact same genes, we couldn't be told apart. We'd sound alike, we'd look alike. But even though nobody looks exactly like you, Sean, and probably nobody ever has, that doesn't mean you represent a new phase in evolution. It just means you're a variation within humanity, totally different from evolution. Now, can racehorse owners develop faster racehorses? Yeah, if you take a fast female horse and mate it with a fast male, you might get a fast offspring. You may be able to win the Kentucky Derby, but there's a limit to the change you'll get. That horse is not going to go 1,000 miles an hour, and you're not going to be able to change it into an elephant. So as people within the creation intelligent design community, we acknowledge, yeah, there is change, but there's a limit to that change. And by the way, if people think that DNA could have come out by chance, let me just quote Bill Gates. He said, quote, DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software we've ever created, unquote. So if you don't think the codes for Windows 7 could come about by chance, neither could the codes for the genetic code.
Yeah, you know, and as we wrap this up, I just want to say again, take a look at the science coming out of CERN. Take a look at what they're doing over at CERN. It's really not being reported upon by the Mockingbird mainstream media. The development of CERN took place really largely in secret. What they're doing really is largely a secret. And if you take a look at the advances in science, molecular biology, sending rockets into space, real hardcore science, this conversation, James, leaves me thinking that Darwin's version of science has about as much science in it as Scientology. So tell me, what's wrong with Darwin's version of science?
Okay. Just to wrap up here, Darwinists will commonly say that the theory of evolution is a science like the laws of gravity. It's like physics and chemistry. And so let's just look at that. You know, physics, there you go, the laws of gravity, right? Chemistry, you know, in chemistry, there's a law that water will boil at 100 degrees centigrade, and that can be tested over and over again. Now, suppose I had a theory that water can boil at 73 degrees centigrade. It'd be easy to disprove my hypothesis. All you got to do is warm water up to 73 degrees. It won't boil. But let's compare that to the claims of evolution. Charles Darwin said, you know why we have so little body hair? It's because our ape ancestors preferred mates with less hair. Now, how do you disprove that? How do you test something that only exists as an idea in the brain of Charles Darwin? To take one other example, there's a paleontologist, Donald Johanson, who found some bones in Africa, which he called Lucy. And he said that Lucy is our ancestor. And he based this on the fact that he believed some of the bones indicated that Lucy may have walked upright. Now, how do you prove that Lucy is not our ancestor? You really can't. You see, physics and chemistry consist of things that you can test right now in present time in a laboratory. Darwinism consists of speculations about things that Darwinists think happened millions of years ago, and there's no way you can test things that happened millions of years ago with the same authority as you can test the present.
Well, I'll tell you what, James. You and I probably are not going to be able to convince any hardcore atheists who believe they have science on their side to come over to our camp, but I just want to leave people with this. Again, we started with commenting on spiritual warfare, at least I did. It's alive and well on planet Earth, folks, and the people that control the paradigm, the Rothschild bankers, the Vatican, the people at the very tippy top of the pyramid that James mentioned earlier in the interview, these people don't want you to know what they're up to. They don't really want you to know their spiritual agenda, which is to worship a beast system, which they are now ushering in at a very rapid pace. Again, look at the Goddard Tunnel opening ceremony on June 1st. It costs more than $8 million, and it tells the narrative of what they believe, who they worship, and what they want to do to humanity. It's time to wake up. It's time to recognize that spiritual warfare on planet Earth is alive and well. And if you believe Darwin's strict theory of evolution, you're believing what the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, and the controllers want you to believe. I can't thank you enough for your time, James. This was a gripping conversation. And you know, last time we had you on, I think we put one of your books up on Amazon's top sellers list. Let's tell people about your books. Let's support James, guys. You can get a copy of Tornado in a Junkyard and or The Case Against Darwin from James Perloff's site, jamesperloff.com, or head directly to Amazon. James, anything else we can do to support you?
No, I should just mention these books are older. They were published in 99 and 02, but the principles are pretty timeless. And, of course, you don't have to go to read one of my books to get the facts on evolution. If you go to my website, jamesperloff.com, I've got a links page, and near the top, there's some links to creation intelligent design sites where you can get this information for free. By the way, just to explain the difference between the two books, The Case Against Darwin is very short. You can read it in a couple of hours. The Tornado in a Junkyard book is intensive. It's over 300 pages long, almost 700 footnotes, and it goes into things that we don't have time to in a show like today's, like dinosaurs and the Scopes trials and things of that nature. Very, very complex and detailed.
All right. Well, very good. Guys, get the book. Support James' work. Let's get him back up on the Amazon bestseller list. That was fun to hear. Yeah, that was a lot of fun to do. And a lot of, you know, we've got great listeners, as you know, James. We have very supportive listeners, wonderful people. James, it's really been my great honor to have you on again. Our last interview, we talked about Truth is a Lonely Warrior and the Shadows of Power. Guys, that'll give you the big picture about the Rothschild banking dynasty and the other banking families that want to enslave humanity. Our guest has been James Perloff. Check him out at jamesperloff.com. And once again, James, thanks so much.
Thank you, Sean. It's been a pleasure.